Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for November 19th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, reinvesting in science in Russia, animal genome plasticity, and linking uncertainty with non-locality in quantum mechanics. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether data from Google could help in predicting the stock market, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The Russian government are making some quite high-profile programs to try and pick up Russian research.
Science's Daniel Cleary reports in this week's issue on how Russia is trying to recapture its past science research glory with the government backing universities and applied research programs.
You know, for a long time, research was very neglected. You know, during the 1990s, there was terrible economic problems in Russia. And science was pretty much ignored. Lots of institutes closed up. Many, many researchers traveled to the West and other countries to find jobs, and some people just left science altogether. So there's a sort of lost generation of Russian scientists. But in the past decade, things have started to pick up, slowly at first. But in the last year, the government has made a big push to fund research in the universities in Russia, which is different from how it used to be. In Soviet times, very little research was done in universities. They were mostly just for teaching. And the research was done in institutes, which the basic science was almost all done in the Russian Academy of Science institutes, of which there were hundreds. And the problem now is that the Russian Academy of Sciences is very independent and quite resistant to reform, and the government has trouble dealing with it. So it seemed as though they were trying to get around this problem by backing research in universities instead.
Why is the Russian government prioritizing science? There are so many other things to spend money on.
That's true. I think because there was a realization towards the middle of the previous decade that their economy was so much based on raw materials, you know, oil and gas and other metals and so on, that you know, they weren't going to last forever. And during Soviet times, they had a very strong scientific tradition and very strong industries, though a lot of them were mostly geared towards defense. So when the Soviet Union ended, that whole system collapsed. And now they have very little applied science, and industry doesn't fund much research. So I think they realized if they wanted to diversify their economy, they needed to make use of the basic research that they still have, but get industry and get applied science institutes to innovate using this research.
Does that mean that there are particular areas of research that the government agencies favor in funding?
Certainly there are. In particular, the thing they seem to be putting the most effort into is nanotechnology. A few years ago, they decided this was where they were going to put all their money, and they created a state-run corporation to finance that, and they gave it a big pot of money, and it's now handing out grants mostly to companies to help them to commercialize products based on nanotechnology. So there's a lot of money flowing around in that area, and a lot of basic science institutes are trying to jump on that bandwagon and get some of this nanotechnology funding.
Suggesting a broader focus on physical sciences in terms of basic research, or are there expanding efforts to stimulate biological and social sciences in Russia too?
I didn't notice that so much. Following the nanotechnology initiative, there was criticism from scientists in Russia and abroad saying that the government was putting all this money into applied research but ignoring basic research, that places like the Russian Academy of Sciences were starved of funds. You know, researchers there were paid pitiful salaries and didn't have much money to do research. And that was certainly true to a degree. But the problem was that the academy hasn't really grasped the sort of modern approach to doing science. So So money is still handed down very much in a sort of hierarchical way, and they don't use peer review and competitive funding to pick which are the best groups and scientists to fund. So there's a lot of waste, I think, and redundancy in the academy, and the government, I think, was trying to get around this problem.
Does it appear as though it's going to be a long-term trend of going around the Russian Academy of Sciences to universities? And if so, what's that mean for the future of the Russian Academy of Sciences?
It's very hard to say what that means for the future. You know, they do seem to be locked in a long-term tussle. The Academy did start a couple of programs that used peer review and competitive funding in about 2003. And one of those programs in molecular and cell biology has been very successful, and it's kept going, and it's really improved science in that area. And people were hoping this would be a model for that sort of funding approach to be spread to other parts of the academy. And that was due to start this year, but then the financial crisis rather knocked that on the head, and the academy's overall budget was cut. And then the academy scaled back funding to this particular program. So it had a budget cut, which has rather taken the momentum out of it. But people are hoping that's only a temporary thing and that this move towards competitive funding will return.
You mentioned that there was criticism both at home and abroad about how money is spent on science. To what extent are there opportunities for international cooperation with scientists in Russia?
Yes, quite a lot of that already goes on. You know, certainly in the 1990s, when they were very, very short of money, Russian scientists made big efforts to reach out to collaborators abroad as a way of getting money to keep going, because they weren't getting any from their own government. And a lot of that still goes on, but it's not enough to really keep as much science going as they once had. You know, science in Russia during the Soviet days was a huge enterprise. You know, they had thousands of institutes and millions of scientists. You know, it was a very big thing. And I think a lot of Russian scientists still look back to that time as a sort of glory days and would like to return to that era.
Well, how about returning to Russia itself? Are any Russian scientists who left after the collapse of the Soviet Union coming home?
I think there are a few, but they're not flocking back in droves yet. One of the programs that the government set up this year was one to attract top international researchers to come back, come to Russia, to set up a lab at a university. I think the idea was a lot of them would be expatriate Russians who would come back, and a lot of the people who applied were expatriate Russians. But it's still small numbers. You know, they've only announced 40 winners of that program so far, and they're going to announce another 40 early next year. So the numbers aren't great. And some researchers have been attracted back by other programs, you know, such as the molecular and cell biology program, for instance. But I don't think they're flooding back. And in fact, this year's physics Nobel Prize winners were both born and educated in Russia, but left during the 90s. They, you know, were quite outspoken about the fact that they had no intention of returning to Russia. They were quite happy working in the UK.
Does that suggest then that Russia will need to, in a sense, grow its next generation of scientists at home rather than trying to lure them back or recruit them from elsewhere?
A lot of people said to me that they felt this approach of trying to lure people back was the wrong way to go. They felt that there was so much potential amongst young students in Russia that they should be looking there. They should be growing their own scientists of the future. And they have a very strong education system and produce great graduates and postdocs. And some researchers feel that's where they should be looking. They should be culturing their own scientists.
Daniel Cleary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's Daniel Cleary reports in this week's issue on how Russia is trying to recapture its past science research glory with the government backing universities and applied research programs. Also in this week's Science, reducing weight gain with hormones. Brad Barnett and colleagues reported a paper published online by Science that they have designed and synthesized a drug that improves glucose tolerance and reduces weight gain in vitro, in cultured cells, and in mice fed a high-fat diet. The way the drug works is by inhibiting an enzyme called GrelinO-acyltransferase. Normally, this enzyme catalyzes a post-translational modification that activates what's known as the hunger hormone, ghrelin. But with regular injections of this designed inhibitor, the mice didn't eat any less than genetically engineered mice that couldn't produce the hunger hormone, suggesting that the drug affects metabolism, not appetite. Read the paper, Glucose and Weight Control in Mice with a Designed GrelinO-acyltransferase Inhibitor, online at scienceexpress.org. Analysis of the newly sequenced genome of an underwater filter feeder animal known as a tunicate is challenging many assumptions about genome architecture. Past research has shown that genomes of animals, from sponges to humans, have a similar genome architecture, suggesting that it is conserved across species. But as Patrick Vinker and colleagues report in a paper published online by Science, this tunicate's genome is surprisingly different, and so shows that the process of natural selection may not be needed to explain genomic architecture. I spoke with Vinker from his office at Genoscope in France.
The paper is presenting the genome sequence of a tunicate called Oikoplura. And Oikoplura has a very compact genome when compared with other animals, in particular with other vertebrates. It's one of the smallest genome of vertebrate, in fact, that has been shown today. So it can be seen as a very rapidly evolving genome that can reveal many particularities that cannot be seen in vertebrates because they grow more slowly.
What prompted you and your colleagues to sequence the genome of this tunicate Oikoplura in the first place?
This genome, in fact, has been sequenced due to a request from collaborators that work on the development of this organism. It is also studied as a model for development because of its fast generation time and some particularities that make it very observable during its development. So the laboratory that requests the sequencing of Oikoplura is from Norway, the laboratory of Bergen from Dr. Daniel Schurut.
And why this particular Oikoplura, the Oikoplura dioica?
There are different species of Oikoplura, but not all of them are easy to breed, in fact, in the laboratory. So Oikoplura dioica is present in most oceans, and it has been bred in the laboratory in Norway from some individuals that were taken from the North Atlantic.
And did you and your team sequence both sexes then?
In fact, we sequenced some male from a collection. So these individuals have been bred in order to make them as inbred as possible, but this really does not go up to a strong inbreeding. So we have still a collection of individuals, and we sequence only males in order to have both chromosomes X and Y.
And why sequence only inbred males?
Well, the inbreeding, in fact, is used very generally when you want to sequence a genome, because if you don't sequence inbred individuals, you have the presence of two different alleles, and sometimes they are very different, so it's very difficult to reconstitute a single sequence from two different alleles.
And did inbreeding lead to a single unchanging genome?
In part. For some regions of the genome, this was possible, but for many other regions, it was not possible. We see that there are regions that were still present in two relatively different alleles, and when we study them a little bit more in depth, we found that this was because there are mutations in some genes that make them impossible to render inbred because they are inactivated.
So this is a rather unexpected thing to...
This happens when you study natural populations, but the frequency at which this should have happened is probably very high in Oikoplura.
You conclude that there were many surprises in the genomic features of this genome, mentioning transposon diversity, developmental gene repertoire, physical gene order, intron, exon organization. What does that mean for researchers who study genomes?
Well, generally you can find one or two of these different features, but Oikoplura has all of them, probably because it's a really very, very fast evolving organism. So first of all, we have seen peculiar intron-exon organization. So we see some basic research on intron creation and retention can be studied in Oikoplura because we have pairs of genes that have different contents in terms of introns. We have also the expression of developmental genes. Oikopleura as a body plant that is relatively conserved, but some specific structure, and we have seen reorientation of the expression of some developmental genes in this structure. And there is also the field of the appearance of sex chromosomes. We have now discovered the sex chromosomes in Oikopleura that are responsible for the separate sexes. And we can study how genes are deposited in this chromosome, how they are conserved, and how they evolve.
Patrick Vinker, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Patrick Vinker of Genoscope is co-corresponding author of a paper titled Plasticity of Animal Genome Architecture Unmasked by Rapid Evolution of a Pelagic Tunicate. Find the paper online at scienceexpress.org. Also in this week's Science, Turning Red Bugs Green. Tsutomu Tsuchida and colleagues report in a paper in this week's Science a bacterium that turns red pea aphid bugs green. Prior research had shown that pea aphid body color is genetically determined with red dominant over green, and because ladybird beetles tend more to consume red aphids, while parasitoid wasps tend to attack green aphids, there is selective pressure for both colors. Now, Tsuchida and colleagues reported finding several strains of green aphids producing red nymphs, as may be expected with red as the dominant color, but as the nymphs grew up, their body color changed to green. Turns out a symbiotic bacterial infection was changing the aphid's body color, and the team estimates that about 8% of P. aphid species in Western Europe carry the infection, which is expected to influence predator-prey interactions as well as interactions with other endosymbiont bacteria. Read the paper, Symbiotic Bacterium Modifies Aphid Body Color, in this week's Science. The physics that Isaac Newton and many others came up with centuries ago to describe our world does a pretty good job at making sense of the force, momentum, and energy we all experience, but it breaks down when it comes to making sense of really small things, atoms and smaller, the quantum world. Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, Max Planck, Erwin Schrödinger all worked on these ideas that would become the field of quantum mechanics. And one of the most fundamental concepts is that of Werner Heisenberg, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which says that it's not possible for all physical properties of really small things, like an atom or a photon, to be well defined at the same time.
We usually say, well, you're trying to measure, say, the position of a particle, and then you won't know the momentum of the particle.
Jonathan Oppenheim is a theoretical physicist at the University of Cambridge.
So you can think about uncertainty as some restriction on how much information you can get.
Oppenheim says that thinking informationally, as he calls it, about quantum theory, helps make sense of the quantum concept of non-locality, too. Non-locality, as Einstein famously derided it, is spooky action at a distance. In other words, that spatially separated quantum systems can instantaneously influence one another. But thinking informationally, Oppenheim says,
you can think of non-locality in terms of questions being asked and information being uncoded.
So with uncertainty described as some restriction of how much information you can get, and non-locality in terms of questions being asked and information being uncoded.
And so when you start to think in those terms, then it starts to appear much more natural that these two concepts might be linked.
And in a paper in this week's Science, Oppenheim and co-author Stephanie Vayner show that these two concepts are linked. The uncertainty principle determines the non-locality of quantum mechanics. Co-author Stephanie Vayner researches quantum information theory at the National University of Singapore.
Of course, because we link these concepts, we can also transfer things we have learned about one of these concepts to understand the others. So, for example, non-locality has been studied quite intensely in quantum information more recently, but uncertainty relations may be less so. But by understanding both things and going back and forth, we can actually sort of obtain an increased understanding of the whole picture.
The whole picture is still quite, well, uncertain. But the work Vayner and Oppenheim have done has theoretically separated out from the other quantum concepts the concept of complementarity. Complementarity is the idea that making one measurement doesn't just make you uncertain about another measurement, as with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, but that it destroys the ability to make another measurement. But, as Stephanie Vayner says,
it can actually happen that, for example, you can have less or more complementary than is possible in quantum mechanics, while having the same or different amounts of uncertainty.
And so both Oppenheim and Vayner say there's a lot more work to do in relating all these quantum concepts together.
You know, quantum mechanics is pretty strange, and any time anyone starts talking about it, if you're not an expert, it sounds really very crazy.
Andrew Doherty is a theoretical physicist at the University of Sydney and is not affiliated with the paper.
So they've made a connection there between two of the really strange and interesting features of quantum mechanics that I think is perhaps a little surprising. So it's almost taking this sort of viewpoint of trying to think a bit like a computer scientist or like an information theorist, and does that tell us something about why quantum mechanics is the way it is? And it seems that that's a pretty fruitful, profitable way forward, and there's a lot of people that are hopeful that we'll better understand the foundations of quantum physics, why it is the way it is, by thinking along these lines.
It's more just getting a clear conceptual framework for our physical theories.
Again, study co-author Jonathan Oppenheim.
And that allows us to start to think about alternative theories, and I think that would be my hope that, you know, I think a lot of us think that maybe quantum theory will be superseded by something else. And if one believes that, then you need to kind of know what is changeable, how can we modify our theories, and what sort of modifications will lead to disasters and what modifications won't. And this work kind of gives us some clues to that. And as Stephanie was mentioning, with the complementarity, we know that we can modify that and it won't really affect the other properties potentially. So it gives us a chance to kind of see what will happen when we play around a bit with other laws that might exist in nature.
You can find Oppenheim and Vayner's paper, "The Uncertainty Principle Determines the Non-Locality of Quantum Mechanics," in this week's Science. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether data from Google could help in predicting the stock market. Some sort of get-rich-quick scheme here, Dave?
Well, that's what the researchers in this study were trying to find out, Rob. This study is all about the search queries that we submit to Google every day. Google collects all these queries on a site called Google Trends. You can say, go to Google Trends and type in the word cat, and it'll tell you how many people were searching for the word cat over the past week. It just sort of gives a sense for what topics are hot or not in the world of the internet. And the researchers in this study said, well, is there a correlation between what people are typing into Google and the activity of a certain stock? For example, if a lot of people are searching for IBM one week, does that mean a lot of people are buying or selling IBM stock the following week?
And did they find this kind of correlation?
Well, they found a correlation, but it's not a correlation that's going to make you wealthy. What they found is that there is indeed a connection between search terms and the activity of stock. What the researchers did was they analyzed this Google Trends data for 6 years, from 2004 to 2010, and then they compared it to the activity of companies on the S&P 500, and these are the big companies that are traded on the stock exchange. And what they found is that there was a connection between search terms and stock activity.
So stock activity, but not necessarily what the price was or whether people are going to buy or sell.
Exactly. The trends indicated that, say, a particular stock would be bought and sold a lot if it was being talked about a lot on the internet, but it wouldn't tell you if the stock was being bought more than it was sold or sold more than it was bought, which would give you an indication of whether the stock price was going to go up or down.
And that's why no one's going to get rich off of this?
That's why no one's going to get rich, although experts say that that data might actually be in there. It's just that we don't have a high enough resolution to see it yet. The drawback of the study is Google Trends only collects data, or at least only shows data, on a weekly basis. So it says for last week, for the entirety of the week, this is how many people were searching for a particular term like IBM. But it doesn't tell you how many people were searching for a particular term on an hourly basis or even a minute basis. And some experts think that if the data was that high resolution, then you could actually potentially predict what was going to happen to a stock price. Now, it's possible Google has that data, but it's just not sharing it with the rest of us.
I suppose, though, that this understanding of Google Trends data being used to predict the stock market might mean that people hearing about this research will start Google trending themselves and start buying stock based on what they think is going to happen. It's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, but at least what these researchers have shown is you're not going to make any money that way, at least for now, unless Google releases much more real-time data than it's releasing right now.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from predicting the stock market to predicting whether an ancient winged reptile could actually fly.
What was the evidence that this reptile couldn't fly, Dave?
Well, Rob, these were huge animals. Pterosaurs, otherwise known as pterodactyls, these flying animals sometimes you've seen in old movies about dinosaurs. They're not actually dinosaurs, but they lived at the time of the dinosaurs. They really ranged in size, but a lot of them were really, really heavy, hundreds of kilograms. You can figure something that heavy is going to have a really hard time getting off the ground. And because they were so big, researchers recently have said these guys probably couldn't get off the ground. In fact, a couple of recent studies that compared pterosaur fossils to those of modern seabirds said that anything larger than about 41 kilograms is not going to be able to get off the ground, which precludes a lot of pterosaur species. But this new study has come along and said, wait a minute, turns out pterosaurs could fly.
What's the new data here?
What they did was they went back to the fossil record and they really took a very close look at pterosaur bones. Now, that's a lot easier said than done because the fossil record for pterosaurs is really scant. And even when these researchers went back and looked at fossils, they looked at fossils from what's today Texas, Romania, and Kansas. They only found bits and pieces, bones that only make up about 5% of the bodies of these animals. But one interesting thing that they did find is when they looked at the humerus bone, and this is, for us, it's the arm bone, and it would have been part of the wing for pterosaurs. They found that these bones were really, really strong, about twice as strong as they would be for an equivalent size bird. Now, that in itself doesn't mean that these guys could get off the ground, but what the researchers think is that they use these arm or wing bones to almost basically launch themselves off the ground. And you can actually see a really cool video of a reconstruction of this happening on the site. And so the idea would be that, yes, they were really heavy, and that would have precluded liftoff, theoretically, but with these really strong arm/wing bones, they were effectively able to catapult themselves into the air. And once they were in the air, they were able to remain airborne.
Well, chickens can get off the ground, Dave, but they don't really fly very far. What's the evidence that these reptiles were actually flying any distance?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And actually, the researchers found a really important piece of evidence for the idea that pterosaurs could actually fly a long distance. One of the fossils they looked at was recovered from what used to be millions and millions of years ago, far out in the ocean, hundreds of kilometers from the shoreline. So you wouldn't expect these guys to be launching themselves from the ocean. They must have launched themselves from land and been flying out far over the ocean. So that's evidence not only did these guys get up in the air, but they were actually able to stay up in the air for quite some time.
Or perhaps they were eaten by a sea-swimming creature.
Right. That is certainly a possibility, Rob, and one that I'm not sure the researchers actually addressed in this study.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from studying pterosaur fossils to learn more about these ancient creatures, to studying feces to learn more about the creatures that live in our intestines. This next story is about all of the microbes swarming around in your gut right now.
What were researchers trying to get at by studying feces?
Well, Rob, they were trying to find out why we have particular species of bacteria in our gut. We actually have up to 1,000 different species of bacteria in our gut. And most other animals do too. These bacteria actually are really important for us. They help us digest food. They make vitamins for us. And yes, sometimes they even produce gas. But they're doing a lot of positive things. But the thing is that researchers really don't know how they got there in the first place and why different species of animals have different species of bacteria and different numbers of those bacteria in their guts.
Well, based on all the products that are being marketed nowadays, probiotics and things like that, I would guess it has a lot to do with what we eat.
Well, and that's been a very popular theory that our diet actually has a really large influence on these bacteria. And that's what researchers set out to confirm in this study, or at least try to confirm. And so what they did was they looked at feces of 26 animals in the wild, 3 subspecies of chimpanzees, 2 species of gorilla, and 2 humans. And if you're curious, 1 from Arizona and 1 from the Central African Republic. So people that live in very different parts of the world.
Suggesting they have very different diets, too.
Exactly. And what the researchers found was they sequenced all the DNA of the bacteria in all these fecal samples, which is a clue to the bacteria that are living in your gut. And they found, as people had expected, that different animals, that the gorillas had different number and type of bacteria than the chimpanzees did, and the chimps had different numbers and types than humans did. But they also noticed something really interesting, that the animals that were more closely related had a lot more gut bacteria in common than those that weren't. So, for example, we're very closely related to chimps on the evolutionary tree, and it turns out the bacteria that we have in our gut is actually very similar to the bacteria that they have in their gut, and actually not as similar to the bacteria that gorillas have in their guts.
So the types of species in our bodies map to the evolutionary tree of life?
Well, it's not an exact map, obviously, but what the researchers did find is that it seems like the closer our evolutionary relationship to another animal, the more we'll have in common with their gut bacteria. So that's the first piece of evidence that seems to throw diet out the window, because even though diet may play a role, it seems that these evolutionary relationships are more important. The other thing that seems to negate the effect of diet is that these two humans, which live in very different parts of the world, probably very different cultures, and like you said, probably very different diets, actually had very similar gut bacteria. So the fact that we were the same species seems to matter a lot more than what our diet was.
Does this finding suggest that we co-evolved with the bacterial species that are growing in us?
That's one possibility. The other possibility is that different species, obviously their guts work a lot differently. They have probably different acidity levels, a lot of different stuff going on. It's possible the environment of our gut just naturally welcomes certain bacteria and sort of shuts the door on other ones. Some bacteria just wouldn't thrive in our gut. And the more closely related to another animal we are, like us and chimps, we probably have very similar gut environments, and therefore we're going to make a nice home for very similar types of bacteria versus an animal that's much more distantly related. But that's just speculation at this point.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about capturing anti-hydrogen atoms. And this is a key first step to studying antimatter. And also a story about lying snakes. This isn't about snakes lying around. It's about snakes that fib. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the final days of this current U.S. Congress and what it means for things like climate legislation and funding for various scientific agencies. And also a story about the rock stars of science. Who are the rock stars in various scientific fields? You can find out on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the November 19th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.